and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the latest Washington Post ABC News poll that has a record number of Americans having an unfavorable impression of Hillary Clinton, with 41% holding a positive view of her, while 56% now dislike her. An expert on polls, David Redlawsk, professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware, whose latest book is The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning, joins us to discuss the reasons why, in spite of her impressive political resume, Hillary Clinton is so unpopular. While Donald Trump is still the only candidate less popular than her, we will look into the vast right-wing machinery that has over the decades thrown everything and anything at the Clintons to taint them with scandal, as well as the sexism inherent in much of the criticism about her voice, her wardrobe, and her appearance that male politicians are not subjected to. Then we will talk about Donald Trump's rise in the polls as he narrowly closes the gap on Clinton and assess whether a few more stunts like Trump's visit to Mexico, with perhaps another surprise trip this time to the Middle East, along with a vote by Italy in October to exit the EU, which could tank the euro and cause economic chaos that would play into Trump's nativist narrative, could be enough for him to win narrowly in November. Keith Poole, distinguished chair in the Department of Political Science in the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and professor emeritus of political science at the University of California, San Diego, joins us to discuss the gloomy prospects for voters this year that might result in a low turnout and an uphill battle for the Democrats to take back the Senate. Then finally, we'll examine the rival demonstrations with hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans taking to the streets in Caracas today, the vast majority rallying against the government of President Maduro, who they blame for the country's economic crisis and accuse of deliberately delaying a referendum until after January the 10th, so that if Maduro is recalled, his loyal vice president will instead serve out his term until 2019. Javier Corrales, a professor of political science at Amherst College and author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela, joins us to discuss a country where crime is rampant and citizens have no security because there is no law and order except when the law is used by the government to repress the opposition. And joining us now is David Redlawsk, who's a professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware. His latest book is The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Redlawsk.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And the Washington Post ABC News poll that came out yesterday shows 41% of Americans have a favorable impression of Hillary Clinton, while 56% have an unfavorable one. And my understanding is, I can't remember when it was, but she was about around 60% favored. Perhaps it was a year ago. But the long and the short of it is, she's on a downward trajectory, isn't she?
Well, she is. If we look at her stint as Secretary of State, for example, she has definitely declined fairly precipitously since that time. But in some respects, that by itself is not surprising. As Secretary of State, she was viewed much more positively because the nature of the role representing the country. There were not at that moment the kind of controversies, and she was not at that moment running for office. Fast forward now, and of course, you know, she's involved in a partisan campaign, a very intense campaign. We've had a year or two or more now of having her beaten up over everything from email to Benghazi. And so there's a certain inevitability about the decline. But having said that, it's certainly a decline that is not necessarily something we see every day. Her ratings as a nominee for a major party are lower than any other in history, with one exception, and that's Donald Trump.
And Donald Trump is turning the tables, is he not? It's pretty clear to me that he's getting much, much better advice if he ever was listening to anybody in the past. There's some doubt as to that. But he's certainly listening to somebody, and it's probably Roger Ailes, supposedly, and Laura Ingraham as well. That I think he pulled off an amazing stunt yesterday in Mexico. He got the president of Mexico to give him a fabulous photo opportunity where he looked statesman-like. And why Peña Nieto did this is a complete mystery. Maybe they just simply paid him, you know. But the long and the short of this guy is possible of pulling off some surprises, and he's reversed the drift in the polls, and he's starting to close on Hillary Clinton.
Maybe, right? I mean, firstly, my theory about the president of Mexico is that he's a huge reality star and always wanted to meet Donald Trump. So there you have it. But I think more seriously, yes, the polls may have shifted slightly over the last couple of weeks, but polls in some sense are a trailing indicator. And by that, I mean they represent what was happening last week or the week before, whenever they were actually in the field, and not what's happening today. I don't think Donald Trump pulled off anything amazing yesterday in the end. I think he whiplashed the public. I think he whiplashed virtually everybody between his comments in Mexico, which quite frankly seemed very subdued and very un-Trump-like, and then his comments in Arizona last night, which just doubled down on the things many people don't like about him, which is the sheer sort of nastiness of his position on immigration.
Well, if you listen to the crowd roaring, it sounded like the Roman Colosseum when they're feeding the Christians to the lions, you know?
Sure, because it's a self-selected crowd of Trump supporters, right?
Right. But that is a finite constituency, the kind of rabble full of haters. But the real issue is how much further he can broaden his appeal, whether Kellyanne Conway can tone him down enough to reach out to the soccer moms and make people feel that you're not voting for a racist. And to some extent, I think yesterday's stunt in Mexico helped him in that regard. But the one
until he stomped on it in Arizona.
Right, but I'm not sure the same people watched both events. We'll see how I was watching the coverage, and I got the impression that the liberal media was being delusional and thinking it didn't count.
Oh, yeah.
Whereas the conservative media were basically saying, yeah, this is looking good. So I'd listen to the latter, not the former on that case. But let me talk about what seems to be a far more disturbing aspect of this ABC Washington Post poll. If you look at the registered voters, that new poll shows Clinton's image is about as bad as Trump's, with 38% having a favorable impression and 59% unfavorable, compared to Trump's 37% favorable and 60%. So they're basically, with registered voters, they're pretty much polling evenly, aren't they?
Right. They are. The question is, where are they with the people who actually will vote, right? Some maybe 60% of registered voters will actually turn out to vote. The interesting thing about all of this is, Clinton is absolutely at historic lows for favorability, and I think it does matter. It's why she doesn't hold a stronger lead over Trump, I think. At the same time, likability is somewhat overrated by the press. I think we could turn to Ted Cruz. Well, Ted certainly didn't win the nomination. He pulled off an upset in Iowa, despite the fact that Ted Cruz is perceived as a highly unlikable person. When voters go into the voting booth, they're making a choice, not an evaluation. And that is a different psychological process. So they may not like Hillary Clinton a whole lot, but when they're going in to vote, the real question is less about how much I like this woman and much more about who do I think is going to be a better job given the choices I have.
So is Hillary Clinton sort of caught between a rock and a hard place in terms of trying to peel off disaffected Republicans? Because the more she moves to the center-right, the logic would indicate that the more she alienates the already alienated Democratic left who voted for Bernie Sanders. And there was some talk that Bernie Sanders would be campaigning for her after Labor Day, but that remains to be seen. But it seems like she sorely needs Bernie Sanders to shore up her left, doesn't she?
Well, I think it is really important that she shores up the left. I think this is the trick in a general election normally, anyway, right? You have to tack to the partisan extreme, one side or the other, depending on which party you're in, to win a primary, and then you've got to tack towards the middle to win a general election. It's always a challenge. This time around, I think it's particularly significant challenge because of the kind of campaign that Bernie ran and the effectiveness of the campaign that he ran against her. You know, Clinton, though, is, despite the fact that I think she makes plenty of mistakes, she's a pretty good politician, and I mean that in a positive way. That is, she kept her campaign going. She, even in the face of the Bernie Sanders challenge, she ran an effective campaign and she won that campaign. But nonetheless, general elections are different. And the more she tries to reach out to Republicans, the bigger the risk there is on the left.
Well, but I think the important factor here, certainly in the down ballot races, in terms of trying to for the Democrats to get the Senate, I don't think they got much of a prayer getting the House, but they seem to think they might get the Senate. Mm-hmm. But if they don't have good turnout, I don't think they got much of a chance. And this is the thing that the Democrats should be worrying about, which is that, the Republicans, their registration is way up in some of the swing states like Pennsylvania. There's excitement on the right with Donald Trump. There's not much excitement for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, and this is actually an ongoing problem for Democrats, right? People who affiliate or view themselves on that side are simply less likely to turn out to vote, and it's partly the nature of who are Democrats, right? We know that folks with fewer resources, we know that, working people who find it hard to get away from the job without losing money, have a much harder time voting. And of course, there are other things going on, including efforts to keep people from voting. So it is a challenge for the left. It's always been a challenge for Democrats. Just look at off-year elections as an example. But I'm not sure the enthusiasm gap is as large as you suggest, although I'll admit I haven't looked at any recent data on it. More than 90% of Democrats say they are going to vote for Hillary Clinton. She's not losing much. And she's not really losing more than Democrats normally lose of self-identified Democrats. And the real question, as you put it, though, is it's one thing to say it in a poll. It's another thing to actually get out and do it. The big advantage I believe she's going to have come, I was going to say election day, but frankly, early voting starts not too far down the pike here, is that she'll have the ground game, and she'll have the ground game that Donald Trump, by all evidence so far, will not have. And that should benefit Democrats up and down the ballot.
So in terms of surprises, if Trump could pull off another couple of surprises like the Mexico one, assuming that that works for him, and certainly the jury is out on that, in October, in terms of October surprises, the Italians are going to have their Brexit vote. And the Nobel laureate, Joe Stiglitz, thinks that it's going to go the way that the British vote did, and it's going to unravel the EU and tank the euro and cause economic chaos. So that might well play into Donald Trump's nativist appeal as well. Do you foresee anything along those lines that could help him?
Well, I think economic dislocation could. I think that, more drip on emails or any one of a number of other things could certainly help him as well. But, I think that we get to a point where lots of voters actually have their minds made up, and that's primarily partisan voters. So the real key thing is the get out the vote piece here. It's that ground game. We say it every time. It matters who shows up. The other piece here is that this electorate does not look like the electorate even 4 years ago. At least it almost certainly won't. Whites make up a smaller and smaller proportion. Non-whites make up a larger and larger proportion. And Donald Trump is polling, even for a Republican, at incredibly low levels among non-white voters. The key, I guess what we'll see, is whether you can still win a national election by counting on disaffected whites when the country has changed so dramatically. I don't think you can. I think that's where Donald Trump's likely to come up short, unless somewhere along the way non-white voters peel off of Hillary Clinton. And so far, I don't see where that would happen.
Well, just in closing, what explains why somebody that's got so much experience and talent, like Hillary Clinton, who's been First Lady, U.S. Senator and Secretary of State, married to a successful president who's got really, I think, widely recognized outstanding political instincts, and yet somehow she's always tripped up and she's never quite straightforward and people don't trust her, which is why we're having this conversation based upon the latest Washington Post, ABC News poll. I mean, I know for decades now the right has done everything they can to associate her with scandal, and they've just thrown everything at her to see what sticks. And you saw hours and hours, I think something like 8 hours before a congressional Benghazi hearing, and none of those small-town, nasty, petty lawyers that represent those congresspeople could lay a glove on her because it's just nastiness. It's just this uncontrolled, irrational hatred that so many on the right have, including Roger Ailes, I might add. They have this obsessive hatred of her. So where is the truth here about her? Is she responsible for her unpopularity, or is this a manufactured unpopularity?
I think it's both of those. I don't think there's ever been a political figure over such a lengthy period of time where one side has been so intent on taking them down forever. This is for as long as a lot of people even have political memories. And a lot of that really is just a continuation of the dislike of the Clintons on the right, the fear of them. But sexism comes into this as well. The kinds of things she gets attacked for sometimes are not things any man would ever be attacked for, right? She's shrill, her hairdo, her pantsuits. I mean, that aspect of it, quite frankly, becomes appalling, but it reinforces all of this. But she's not the best campaigner as a person. She has that tendency to believe that, the things that matter to the public shouldn't matter to the public. The whole email thing has been handled as inartfully as you could even begin to imagine. And it's partly just the mindset for Hillary Clinton of, I know I'm doing right. Why doesn't everybody else?
Well, David Redlawski, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with David Redlawski, who's professor and chair of the Department of Political Science and International Relations at the University of Delaware. His latest book is The Positive Case for Negative Campaigning. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing the gloomy prospects for voters this year that might result in a low turnout. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Keith Poole, who is the Philip H. Alston Jr. Distinguished Chair in the Department of Political Science at the School of Public and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches, and his latest book is Political Bubbles, Financial Crises and the Failure of American Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Keith Poole.
Nice to be here, and the Polarized America book is now out in the second edition. well, this year, 2016.
And, right. And there's no question that America is polarized. And in terms of this presidential race, it does look like Donald Trump is catching up fast. He pulled off quite a brilliant stunt yesterday in Mexico, where he had a great photo opportunity with the president of Mexico for reasons I don't understand why he allowed himself to be used by Trump. But nevertheless, it does seem that if Trump could pull off a few more stunts like the Mexico trip, he could win the presidency.
Yes. Always remember that Trump may be a mountebank and an entertainer, but he is not stupid. And as a consequence, if he listens to his campaign team, his new one, and his children, he'll repeat this by going over to the Middle East. But yeah, he's the only reason he's even in the race is that Hillary Clinton is the worst candidate of a major party in the history of the polling, except for Donald Trump. And basically, you know, Hillary Clinton is, you know, William Sapphire in 1996 wrote a classic column. She's a liar. And frankly, if it weren't for the fact that the Justice Department was so politicized, she should be indicted for perjury before Congress. She's manifestly guilty of perjury, a felony, and but they won't do anything. And but she's liable to back in just because Trump is, frankly, you know, he's an entertainer. He's a mountebank, which is a 19th century term for like W.C. Fields on the back of a wagon selling magic elixir, which was always just morphine, sugar, and alcohol. And it's stunning that American politics has been produced, has been reduced to this choice. It's just shocking, to be honest. Shocking.
Well, you correctly state Hillary Clinton's unpopularity because just yesterday the Washington Post ABC News poll came out giving her record low poll numbers. 41% of Americans have a favorable impression of Clinton, while 56% have an unfavorable one. So she's on a downward trajectory in terms of her popularity, but Trump is on an upward trajectory in terms of his poll numbers. And it's hard to understand why Hillary Clinton is so flat-footed in her campaign. But I noticed, for example, I was watching the coverage of Trump last night on MSNBC, and they're all in the bag for the Democratic Party, as you well know, just as much as Fox's News is in the bag for the Republicans. But they were...
I would correct one thing.
What?
Fox doesn't like Trump. I mean, they it's true that some of the people like Hannity and some of those, you know, snake oil salesmen love Trump. But Bret Baier and forget the other major news, they don't like Trump at all. But, yeah, I take your point. Your point is a good one, yeah.
Well, but also O'Reilly is definitely promotes Trump as well.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So O'Reilly, he's getting some pretty good airtime.
Another snake oil.
Yeah.
Another snake oil salesman, yeah.
Sure. But the point I wanted to make about this liberal bubble, which Hillary Clinton and many of the MSNBC commentators are, they were just asking the usual protest question, is he hardening on immigration? Is he softening? And they completely, you know, whenever you had conservatives on, like Bill Kristol and Hugh Hewitt, explaining that this is playing well with the conservative America, they're just in denial. They don't understand. It's as though people are talking past each other in this country. Neither side understands what motivates the other. I find it pretty extraordinary, and that's why I think Trump could pull off a surprise, because there's an awful lot of people out there.
I do. Yeah, I do, too. I would still put my money on Hillary Clinton, but I would no longer say that the Democrats were had a slam dunk on the Senate. The Republicans are going to clearly hold the House, probably 225 seats, maybe 228, something like that. Senate will look dicey, but as the higher Trump goes, the less liability he becomes. And the reason, one of the things, there was a very insightful piece in National Review, the latest National Review, which, by the way, hates Trump with a passion. Remember, these are the people, Bill Buckley, conservative intellectuals who read the John Birch Society out of the Republican Party. And this guy had a really good take, I think, on one of the things that's happening right now. He's the author of this book, well-regarded book, Hillbilly Elegy, about what's happened to the sort of white working classes. And one of the things that's very disturbing about what's happening in the United States right now is that, number one, about the lower 50% of income, or technically, if you want to say, the bottom two quintiles of income in real dollars, have not increased since about 1975. Almost exactly the same time, simultaneously, has been remarked on by a lot of people. Including Thomas Piketty in his big book, Capitalism. You see this striking divergence of real productivity versus real wages. In other words, in 1976, you get this dramatic shift where real productivity keeps climbing and real wages just don't. They don't capture the gains in the productivity. So one of the things that's happened, I think, is not only from the there's several moving parts here. One of course, is the information revolution, but it's also the fact that we've deindustrialized, and what's happened to the black middle class is that in 2007, 2008, they were disproportionately hammered by the meltdown of the banks. And so one of the reasons why Trump and Bernie Sanders have such appeal and why you're seeing this sudden uptick in racial tension, which if you think back, and again, this piece in the National Review, I think, does a very fair job of explaining it. 20 years ago, even though, you know, there was lots of problems with driving while black, it looked like things were getting better for everybody. And now they're not. And so we've got two underclasses. We've got this white underclass out there in West Virginia and Kentucky and the Rust Belt, and we've got a serious, huge epidemic of heroin and fentanyl that's pouring in over the Mexican border. That's one thing Trump is right about. And things for African Americans went downhill. You know, they had these gains in the 90s, and then it got wiped out by this meltdown. So that the real issue ought to be is how on earth are we going to get the economy moving? Because once the economy gets moving, you're going to see more cities start to burn and things are going to get really bad, especially if, say, Hillary Clinton just simply goes to identity politics for 4 years. Then 4 years from now, things are going to get infinitely worse. I'm very worried about the country because I don't see way we've got to tax away some of the gains of the super rich. That isn't going to get us all the way there. We've got to get the economy moving, and the economy under the last two presidents. Everybody talks about Obama, but President Bush the second, in addition to his disastrous Iraq war, was also a huge regulator. And so we've had two straight disastrous presidents in terms of economic performance and the waste of money overseas. And now we've got these two people running for president who, you know, get Hillary Clinton to give you a coherent answer on what she's going to do about Syria, for example. I just don't know. I mean, what I say to students, what I would say to anybody listening to my voice, imagine instead of having to go into the voting booth and choosing between these two losers, you had the opportunity to choose between Cain and Pence. Imagine a press conference where the press could have Governor/Senator Cain what his policies would be about, improving economic performance. Ditto with Pence. Both have had both executive experience and congressional experience, and they so dwarf their counterparts, it's really a disgrace, frankly. That's how bad things are, in my opinion.
But why do you think it is that to someone with Hillary Clinton's extraordinary experience, is quite unique to have been a first lady, a senator, and a secretary of state, and her husband is clearly an incredibly effective political operator with good political instincts. Why is it that she doesn't recognize that the ground has shifted under her feet, that people are fed up with status quo politics, they're fed up with the way it is? You can't tinker with the system. You got to change it. And you got this complete con man out there talking about how he's going to change the system, and he's tapping into all that anger. And, of course, all he's going to do is dig the hole deeper because he doesn't represent anybody but himself.
Yeah, and the other thing that is just flabbergasting me about the Clintons is, why do they continually cut corners? Why does she continually just lie, bald-faced lie? Why, you know, I mean, but you're right. I mean, she has an opportunity to lay out an economic program that would draw, I think, fairly broad support. There's deals to be made in Congress about ending the sequester. There is a deal to be made about fixing the corporate tax structure that everybody agrees is a disaster. And there's deals to be made on getting things cleaned up in foreign affairs. But, you know, she's going to be dogged by this email thing until past the election. It isn't going to go away. And I just don't know what to tell you. I mean, just she has a lot of talent, but it sort of reminds me, older listeners may understand this comment, reminds me of Gary Hartpence, who had to lie about his age by 1 year. I mean, why doesn't he just come out and lay out clear public policies, but she's stuck on these on identity politics? So what you see is what you're going to get, I think. I don't see her changing, and the fact that she's kind of stuck with the current Democratic Party, that just leaves it open for Trump to pull these surprises, like go to Mexico, or maybe go to the Middle East next. She's not going to get a landslide, that's for sure now, I think.
Well, the point that you made earlier, though, about the real macroeconomic trends, which is there's a very important graph that shows how household income and productivity tracked in parallel all the way up until the end of the 1970s. And then the trend lines diverge.
76.
Yeah, 76.
Yeah, then they diverge
where all of the benefits of productivity, all the benefits of productivity go to capital and not to labor, and labor is in a slow, steady decline. That is at the heart of the problem, isn't it? We need some imagination.
Yeah, it is.
We need some imagination out there on the part of politicians and economists to say there's got to be a way to reverse the benefits of or to share the benefits of increased productivity, not just have them all go to the top.
Yeah, we need creative thinking. And there's also, you know, there have been a number of authors who have written about, you know, the rise of artificial intelligence and how important that is. For example, and that plays into this very thing. For example, 2007-08, the meltdown 40% of those jobs in the financial industry never came back. They were replaced by computer algorithms of some kind or another. So that you're exactly right. What's one of the things that's going on is that the returns to capital are increasingly concentrated in a tinier and tinier slice at the top end, not only the income, but the capital owners. And we haven't, you know, I think one thing that we could do that I agree with her about is that we really need to rebuild. We need to really rebuild our highways and the interconnections between the highways and major rail centers and so forth, because our labor costs now have dropped so far that you could get some of this light manufacturing back to the United States. And you need to focus on more of a German model where you train especially young men who've really been, well, you know, thrown off the bus.
Well, just in closing, the other thing that could also help Trump is in October, the Italians vote on their version of a Brexit, and it's likely to go, as Joe Stiglitz, the economist, the Nobel economist, thinks it's that the Italians are going to pull out and it's completely going to unravel the euro and the EU. So there's another incident of something that could help Trump. So I guess...
not only that, if you're a believer in the fact that Snowden was actually a Russian agent, which I think he was, my guess is that between the Russians and Julian Assange, they have all this information that they'll start, you know, to perform as much damage. For some reason, Julian Assange hates Hillary Clinton, and so don't be surprised if stuff starts coming out. And remember, Putin is an old KGB guy. He's got his start in East Germany, who, you know, rose to the power he has by systematically blowing up apartment blocks of his own citizens. He's a bloodthirsty mafia boss, and not to be underestimated. I think he may try to meddle in our election.
Well, Keith Poole, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You bet. Have a good weekend.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Keith Poole, who's the Philip H. Alston Jr. Distinguished Chair in the Department of Political Science in the School of Public Affairs and International Affairs at the University of Georgia and Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of California, San Diego. He's the author of Polarized America, The Dance of Ideology and Unequal Riches. And his latest book is Political Bubbles, Financial Crises and the Failure of American Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the rival demonstrations in Caracas, Venezuela today, the majority rallying against the government of President Maduro.
Se dan de cuenta que un corazón amarrado, cuando le sueltan las riendas, es caballo desbocado. Y si una potra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a falseta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Javier Corrales, who's a professor of political science at Amherst College, who serves on the editorial board of Latin American Quarterly Politics and Society and America's Quarterly, and has also been a consultant for the United Nations, the Center for Global Development, and the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. He's the author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela, now out in a second edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Javier Corrales.
Thank you very much.
And there were huge competing or rival demonstrations today in Venezuela's capital, Caracas. The opposition were aiming on getting 1 million people out. They claim to have succeeded in that. They were wearing white. They blame President Nicolas Maduro for the country's incredibly deep economic crisis. And they also accuse him of forcing the Electoral Commission to, or deliberately having the Electoral Commission delay a referendum that, if it takes place after January the 10th and Maduro is recalled, he can just put his loyal vice president in to serve out his term till 2019. Whereas if he was recalled before January the 10th, then he would be gone. So that is what the opposition want. But Maduro himself addressed a pretty large crowd as well. So this was a battle of the numbers, I take it. So did the opposition get the 1 million, and was Maduro able to get enough of his people out on the streets to make it a draw?
Sure. We don't have official numbers. The government made it difficult by banning drones, for example, to make estimates of how many Venezuelans took to the streets today. They probably didn't make 1 million, but they came to a spectacularly large number, perhaps close to 500,000. This was just a protest in the city of Caracas. There were a number of obstacles to getting into the protest sites. So although the number didn't quite make it to 1 million, it was pretty significant. Whereas the numbers in support of the government were very low, probably fewer than 50,000. So as a contest of numbers, it seems that the opposition really had a good day.
Well, the government itself has, first of all, the government controls the media almost entirely. It's sort of turned into a similar situation that exists in Russia under Putin. So they've had enormous advantages. They've been jailing all the opposition figures they could get their hands on, except for, of course, the leader of the opposition. But Daniel Ceballos, the opposition Popular Will Party leader, he was under house arrest, and they arrested him because they thought he might join the demonstrations.
Yeah.
It just seems so arbitrary. I mean, obviously, Capriles is the opposition leader. They were too obvious if they went after him. But they've also gone after the press. They've blocked the entrance of most of the foreign press. I'm just astounded at how, for example, European and American leftists continue to sort of make excuses for this guy. How could you ruin an economy in a country that's oil rich, it has the biggest oil reserves in the world, as far as I know, and screw things up so badly and somehow get a free pass as a revolutionary hero where you spend every waking minute blaming the Americans for everything? And frankly, I don't think the Americans give a damn about, they don't have to destabilize the place. Maduro is doing a hell of a job on his own.
That's right. You're absolutely right. It is remarkable that there are still some apologists for this government, although I do have to say that they are fewer and fewer. The international press is now very aware of how repressive the government has become and how inept it is. Has been for a while now in handling the economics. But you're right. Ultimately, there are still many important figures in the left who do not openly criticize him. But the level of admiration perhaps has gone down, and you have to ask, what more can he do? Because he has pretty much done everything wrong. This president, Nicolas Maduro, has very few positive signs, very few positive steps that he has taken that are worth admiring. Really a dismal performance because, as you say, this was an incredibly wealthy country that had a wonderful run in the 2000s. And has been in a recession now for 3 years, and it's getting worse. Things are not turning around. And a number of important economists have offered a good list of possible solutions, and the government simply refuses to implement anything that would amount to a real recovery program.
Well, it's pretty extraordinary, the level of denial, though. When you got people flooding into Colombia next door, selling gasoline in Colombia, and the shops being looted, and lines around, worse than anything they ever had in the Soviet Union. I mean, you had a piece, Javier Corrales, in the Huffington Post recently, where you suggested that somehow Maduro is using starvation or deprivation of food and staples as a political weapon. The title of the piece was How Venezuela's Repressive Government Controls the Nation Through Hunger. What kind of a strategy is that?
Sure. Let me provide some background. Venezuela is looking like a typical Soviet republic in the 1980s with long bread lines. There is a significant level of scarcity. And I'm talking about very long lines to get very basic consumer goods like sugar and basic groceries. And what is happening is that the government has used those lines to establish a system of controls, just like the Soviet Union did. Everybody has to register. The government controls how much you buy, how much you can buy. And it then offers special help to loyalists to get by the situations of scarcity, sort of like, you know, they'll tell the right people what stores are going to have groceries available. So on the one hand, they are forcing most Venezuelans to stand in line and to register and to spend quite a bit of their day just standing in line. But then at the same time, they're offering some of their supporters a special pass, if you will. So it's a very clever strategy in many ways. The problem is that Venezuelans are incredibly sick of this. The protests today reveal how much discontent there is. Even if the government has been able to use these new controls and situations of scarcity in order to make some inroads in controlling the population, the level of discontent is something that I have not seen in Venezuela, and I would even say in Latin America, in decades now. So it's not clear that the government strategy in the end is winning. If I may say something more, earlier you mentioned that it seems like the government is in some type of denial. And in many ways they are, but it's also important to remember the other point you made, which is they're simply waiting for January 10th, 2017, because after that date, if there is a recall referendum and the government loses, Maduro would need to resign. That is true, but there is no new election. Instead, power gets transferred to the vice presidency. So in many ways, the entire government is just sort of like waiting for the storm to waiting until January 10th. And so they don't care what happens to the country. They don't care what happens to the economy. They are staying put and making sure that they survive until January 10th. Until then, I don't think we're going to see major economic policy changes.
So when the people in the streets today, those in protest of the government, were saying, if we are going to defeat hunger, crime, inflation, and corruption, are they simply are they powerless? They may have the numbers, but they simply I mean, one of the things that I've observed over the years is that the opposition has not been particularly, first of all, you have a history of a country run by indifferent oligarchs who basically took care of themselves and nobody else. And then the Popular Revolution under Hugo Chavez did spread the wealth. And now it's reached a point of absurdity where people only pay 5 cents a gallon for gasoline, but they can't buy toilet paper. And they've lent money all over the place. I mean, it's just, it's the most amateurish government imaginable. And of course, they simply, as you just pointed out, they don't deal with reality. They just postpone it. And in this case, all they care about is holding on to power. So they want to hold on past January the 10th. And they don't seem to have a vision. But is the opposition any better than it's been? I mean, this wouldn't have been going on for so long had there been a less feckless opposition.
This is a very important question. There are two ways of answering it. If the question is, have they been able to defeat the government, make institutional inroads? Well, there have been a few successes. They reconquered the parliament, which was significant. But other than that, there are no major victories to the opposition. But at the same time, it's very difficult to fight this kind of government. This was a government that was enormously popular, and it's a government that controlled so many institutions, like you said, the press, but also the military, the oil company, the ruling party became very extended throughout poor neighborhoods. So it was very difficult. And through it all, this opposition has maintained unity, and it hasn't been defeated. You don't see here a total victory by the government, even though the game is very much stacked in the government's favor. So the fact that the government hasn't been able to neutralize this opposition is a testament to some of the huge achievements by this movement. But like you said, they haven't been able to achieve the most important thing, which is to produce a change in government or a change in policies.
But how many people still, I mean, you pointed out how Maduro's government essentially bribes the apparatchiks to keep them loyal, and presumably there's still some vestiges of admiration for Hugo Chavez and his revolution that had the poor rise up in a country that has always been, or had up until then been run by, you know, the 1%, for the want of a better description. So that there's obviously some vestiges of that kind of, it seems like the whole place went to hell in a handbasket when Chavez died. It was simply his successor. It just lacked not just charisma, but lacked any kind of competence. But at the same time, if you're living in a country where, you know, as I say, it's hugely oil rich, you can't get toilet paper, you can't get food, you spend your day lining up, and you can get shot and mugged in the street at any moment, and it happens to everybody. That's just basically no politician in this country could ever get elected on a record like that. So that's what I find mystifying. Is it simply because they control the press, the military, and the police? I'm trying to find an explanation for how they could be this incompetent and make lives so miserable for people whose money just disappears on a daily basis with inflation. It's a crazy patchwork of the most insane improvisations imaginable.
Right. Well, I think you have been able to explain why it is that the government refuses to have an election. They are perfectly aware that this enormous reservoir of support, which this ruling party once had under when Hugo Chavez was alive, and even in the first year of the Maduro administration, this whole reservoir has been depleted. It's not completely exhausted, but it's certainly minoritarian based on what we have from polls. And so the government's refusal to have a referendum is complete evidence of what you're saying. They are now at a point where they have no electoral prospects. And so they are postponing not just a recall referendum, but they're probably going to postpone an election for state governors that is supposed to happen in December. precisely because of this depletion of support. But I must say that there were many folks who supported Chavez and this movement with their hearts more than with their brains. They were very much in love with the revolution and the idea. And that's a very, for somebody who comes with that political background, to turn against this government is a very difficult issue. It's not sort of like, let me see whether I'm going to support candidate A or this other or the opposition. People were very, very emotionally committed to this movement. And this is what makes the level of disappointment that exists in Venezuela today so significant. These are not just regular voters who are disappointed. It's people who were very, very emotionally connected to this revolution who are now incredibly disappointed, and this gives you an idea of the magnitude of the magnitude of the errors that the government has committed.
Well, I guess just in closing, in the last few seconds, then, is it possible that if the government's running out the clock, is there anything that can be done to get the referendum done before January the 10th, or are they just going to run the clock out and hold on to power via the vice president?
Well, that's what the government wants to do. They want to just let time go by and postpone. But the opposition has already announced a bigger march for next week. Today's march took place exclusively in Caracas by design. For next week, they have organized a march to cover all state capitals, so probably 24 cities. The idea is to continue pressuring the government. So we will see what happens. That's going to be the next battle.
Well, thank you again for joining us, Javier.
My pleasure. Let me just say one thing. It is very important to highlight the level of criminality that exists in Venezuela. Although nobody knows the numbers, everybody who studies the issue realizes that the murder rate in Venezuela, and especially in cities, is astronomical. You just don't see the level of criminality in countries with that level of income. It just doesn't happen. And this is, in many ways, a sign of the government's incompetence. Essentially, there is no police force, no law and order, and so it pays to become a criminal. And so, essentially, this is the only way that many Venezuelans have of making a living is to turn into criminals. And criminality is very vicious, and it attacks everyone of all income types. Everybody is subject to this, and this is now what it is like to live in Venezuela now, which is a country where simply the state is refusing to provide basic law and order, except to repress the opposition.
Well, again, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Take care, Ian.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Javier Corrales, who's a professor of political science at Amherst College, and he's the author of Dragon in the Tropics, Hugo Chavez and the Political Economy of Revolution in Venezuela, now out in an updated second edition. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.